Ladies and gentlemen, I should like to welcome you to our seventh lecture of this 1960-61 series. We're delighted to have you with us here this evening to hear a distinguished Canadian writer and educator. He was born and educated in Ontario, and Dr. Bissell has had a brilliant scholastic record, as you all know, both at the University of Toronto and at other institutions. He graduated from the University of Toronto in 1936 and took his Master of Arts degree in 1937. In that year, he was awarded the Cornell Fellowship in English and proceeded to that institution, where he received his Doctor of Philosophy's degree. In 1941, he returned to Toronto and was employed there in his beginning of his career as a lecturer in English. Between the years 1942 and 1946, he was on leave of absence, and he served in our Army overseas with the Argyle and Sutherland Highlanders. He returned in 1946 to the University of Toronto, where in 1948 he was made assistant to the president. In 1952, he was appointed vice president, and in 1956, he went to Carleton University to assume the administrator's job of presidency there. In 1958, on the decease of Dr. Smith, he was appointed president of the University of Toronto. He has been honored by University of Manitoba, University of McGill, Queen's, and other universities with honorary doctor's degrees. And only this year, he was appointed chairman of the Canada Council. It gives me a great deal of pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Claude Bissell, the president of the University of Toronto.
Mr. President and ladies and gentlemen, it is an honor indeed to join the company of scholars and men of affairs whom you have asked to speak before this body. And it is particularly pleasant to speak at this university, which in its combination of youthful vigor and mature achievement constitutes a happy Canadian symbol. Since I have so many friends and former associates at the University of British Columbia, I'm sorry that my visit is so short and so oratorical. I'm reminded of those sly warriors in Earl Burney's poem who stow briefcase ammunition for some chosen target, preparing for assault by speech in Winnipeg or awaiting some Vancouver beachhead. And in my case, Mr. President, I have bypassed Winnipeg, but I'm proposing to enlarge the beachhead in California. My subject, as your president has told you, is the future of higher education in Canada. This is, I should think, the most expansive and the most sweeping subjects of all those in your series, and this, you might say, is a fit assignment for one who is at one and the same time a university president and a Torontonian. Because an occupational propensity for exuberant imprecision is reinforced by the accident of geography. I shall try to overcome some of the more bewitching temptations of the subject by beginning with what I believe to be accurate description and only gradually drifting into speculation. So what follows then is a mixture of reality and vision. Some of you may have trouble in determining where the one ends and the other begins. Indeed, the whole speech may strike you as totally visionary. In that case, I can only plead the general heady environment of the West Coast and the nice suggestion that your officers had in mind when they asked me to speak on this day of the great Canadian Saturnalia. Robert Oppenheimer, the great physicist, has recently suggested that human knowledge doubles every 8 or 11 years. He was speaking, of course, of scientific knowledge. The rate of change elsewhere is blessedly less rapid, and human institutions, like universities, are still able to encompass the new within the framework of the old. And yet, such explosive change must inevitably affect institutional patterns. And certainly, I think this is true of universities that have been traditionally the most conservative of all human institutions. Those of us whose university careers have been mainly in the post-Second World War era have been so deeply involved in these changes that we have found it difficult at times to recognize what is happening. But now that these patterns are beginning to emerge, we can see what has been the course of development during the last 15 years or so. And I would like to begin with a general description of what the common concept of higher education was up till the beginning of the Second World War. I am, of course, deliberately arresting a process and trying to extract a few key stills from a moving picture. What then is this, what I might call, pre-war concept of higher education? Well, higher education, in this sense, was largely synonymous with the university. And the university looked after a very small minority in society. The percentage of college-age youth attending university between the turn of the century and, say, 1930, I think we could take that up to 1940, did not vary greatly. It rose during this period only from 2 to 4%. And this small group was determined by a mixture of economic, social, and academic criteria. The function of higher education, which, as I have said, was largely synonymous with the university, was, if I may strip the commencement of day addresses of their verbiage, to prepare an individual for a specific profession. The graduate school, particularly in this country, was a minor excrescence, and almost its sole job was to turn out university professors. University education was conceived of as the final processing of a product before it was released for the market. This process was constantly repeated and was subjected only to minor changes. The university did not see itself as the initiator of ideas and movements. Creativity belonged to the years after an individual had left the classroom, and the centers of action in our society were, I think, largely outside the university. It was common in commencement day addresses to talk of the international character of higher education and how the scholar rose loftily above national boundaries. But actually, the university was a national institution, even at times a parochial one, and its internationalist faith was more an assertion of good intentions than an earnest of accomplishments. I have, of course, grossly simplified, no doubt in this very summary attempt to sketch in a concept of higher education which existed before the Second World War, I'm revealing some of the complacent superiority of the present toward the past. Now, the change that I am about to sketch is usually referred to as an expansion, which I think is a misnomer, because expansion suggests a stretching of the old, whereas what we are concerned with here is an explosive process. The first of the new factors at work was the opening up of areas for higher education that once seemed to be completely alien. Business and industry, for instance, moved vigorously into the field of higher education, first of all on the technological side, and more recently, and with far greater éclat, on the management side. William White and other commentators on the social scene have described in detail the process of almost uninterrupted training that goes on after a young man leaves the university and becomes part of a large corporation. Indeed, one gets the impression today that the young executive is in a perpetual state of pupillage. Some of the large corporations have created super centers of higher education with budgets of such glistening proportions that university administrators are inspired to re-examine their deficits, hopefully. The educational budgets of large corporations often rival those of good-sized colleges, and the expenditures per student are 2.5 or 3 times the national average for colleges and universities. This refers primarily to the American scene, but I suspect is true of our own. In addition to the training seminars, the large corporations, at least the American ones, have poured millions into research, an activity which governments also have pursued. Such research bodies are now the major consumers of our PhDs in the pure sciences and are often our most formidable competitors, both for staff and for kudos. Sometimes a gentlemanly alliance exists between the governmental and the Business Institute of Research on the one hand and the university on the other, although sometimes I think with a feeling on the university side of genteel inferiority. Well, this movement of business into higher education is perhaps the most formidable part of what might be described as the popularizing of higher education. Any city university, this one I'm sure, knows about the demands that are made by the part-time student, sometimes studying for a degree or a certificate, usually following knowledge for its own sake with a Tennysonian dedication. And this process has been accelerated by television, which can carry the classroom, once a closed arcanum, into 1 million living rooms. Although the opening up of these new areas has effectively destroyed the monopoly of the university in higher education, it has not thereby removed its centrality. The business corporation may maintain expensive management training courses under its own jurisdiction, but it hankers after the peace and the sense of tradition and ultimately the authority of the university campus. The research institute, whether business or government controlled, may have enormous resources, but it can still never expect to do the kind of durable, fundamental work that is carried on in the laboratories of the university. The potentates of television are discovering that professors are natural performers who unwittingly seem to have devoted their lives to a preparation for television careers. And of course, the simplest demonstration of the continued centrality of the university is the great increase in the full-time student body, which has already been referred to so frequently and in such great detail on so many academic platforms that I shall take great care not to document it. While this vertical movement was taking place, a horizontal movement was underway. Higher education had become a tough strand binding together the national life. It was also becoming a hopeful strand in the creation of an international community. Physical mobility was accompanied by intellectual mobility. The movement of ideas and information was seen to be as important as the movement of goods. That is why universities have become instruments of international policy. The present international conflict is in large part a battle between information systems. In order to take their place on this broadened international scene, universities moved into areas that previously they neglected or slighted, and belatedly took up the study of the ancient and powerful civilizations that threatened Western hegemony. It is the battle of what I have described as information systems that has given point to the international obligations of universities. And it is obviously this, more than any disinterested concern for the welfare of underdeveloped nations, that has inspired the rash of international exchange scholarships. I might mention a few of these. Since the end of the war, Canadian universities have become important agencies by which the federal government has implemented many of its international responsibilities. This has not come about by any sudden development in governmental policy. The simple fact is that in many areas of international concern, the government would be powerless without the university, or would have to create special agencies, and this at great cost. Of the various international plans in operation, the Colombo Plan is the oldest and the most extensive. It has already supported the training of more than 2,000 men and women in Canadian universities. The Canada Council, through its non-resident scholarships and fellowships, brought 85 foreign scholars to Canada in 1959-1960. And in the same year, 200 holders of National Research Council postdoctorate fellowships were working in Canada. The most recent scheme, which was initiated under the guiding hand of my predecessor at Toronto, is the Commonwealth Scholarly Program, in which Canada participates both as host and beneficiary. Next year, for instance, about 100 Commonwealth students will come to Canadian universities, and more than twice that number in succeeding years. And there are also numerous smaller groups of students who come either at the expense of their own governments — Ghana and the United Arab Republic are two recent examples — or at their own expense, for whom places have been found at Canadian universities by the Canadian Universities Foundation, acting on behalf of the Canadian government. Universities have been happy to accept this additional burden in the knowledge that they thereby make a substantial contribution toward the easing of international tension and to the resolution of economic and social problems. Recent events in Africa have dramatized the role of higher education in the process of changing from colonial to independent status. The future of these new African countries depends upon the speed with which they can be supplied with well-trained personnel. Their own universities, if they have them, have restricted undergraduate and no graduate facilities. For graduate work, they look to Western universities, increasingly to universities on the North American continent. Bringing foreign students to our universities is one way of accelerating the industrial and social revolution in these new countries. Sending our own technicians to these countries is just as important and more immediately effective. In his speech to the United Nations, the Prime Minister of Canada referred to the possibility of Canada creating a roster of experts in medicine, public health, sanitation, public welfare, communication, transportation, and public services for service under the aegis of the United Nations in the newly liberated countries. Clearly, these experts can come only from the universities. Such a roster of experts cannot be organized overnight. There must be a considered plan whereby students in the professional schools and the universities would engage themselves to serve for such a purpose. Today, one hears on all sides emotional exhortations about the necessity for self-denial and for a bold proclamation of our Western democratic faith. Here is one very simple, practical way in which we can respond to the appeal. These are precise, practical ways in which the universities of this country are discharging their international obligations. But they can play an international role of even greater significance. That is the creation, and this is, I think, the aspect which has particular significance for the future, that is the creation of pilot international communities drawn together by an allegiance to international ideals. Robert Oppenheimer, if I may again refer to him, has said in one of his recent essays, to fraternal communities of men embarked on specialized work, those who know how to extirpate malaria, those who seek to understand the radio signals coming to us from remote parts of the universe, those who recreate the early history of man, his art and his learning. Their knowledge and know-how bind them together as possessors of true community, complementary to the local geographic communities, complementary to the communities of states and civic tradition. They are the warp of community as the nations are the woof. These communities of the mind are the human counterpart and the basis of the international institutions that the future must hold in store. And on them rests, it seems to me, the fact that we will survive this unprecedented period in the history of man. Well, the kind of international community to which Professor Oppenheimer refers has already been achieved in many areas of the sciences, as Professor Tuzo Wilson's book, One Chinese Moon, so delightfully illustrates. In science, where rigorous objective criteria prevail, and where human emotions and passions are irrelevant, a sense of community develops easily. But a sense of community is achieved far less readily in the humanities and social sciences, where objectivity disappears in the play of human emotions and prejudices. Some of the problems here were illustrated at the International Conference of Orientalists held in Moscow during this summer. But even here, according to some of my informants, it is possible to achieve a degree of understanding, provided one is not obsessed by a passion for uncovering sinister implications and for transmuting every slightly tendentious phrase into political propaganda. We can make such an understanding more possible by strongly supporting the study of those civilizations that challenge our Western assumptions. And such studies must not be looked upon simply as the eye branch of a massive military preparation. Indeed, the very approach to another culture in these manipulative terms leads to a loss of perspective and to distortion, and prevents the scholar from attaining that disinterested sympathy by which alone he can reach a real comprehension of culture not his own. What we need is to be conscious of living in a world of diverse cultures that increasingly impinge upon each other, instead of in a world that is deeply and irrevocably divided. A major test of the university's contribution to this international spirit is the emphasis it gives to the study of these cultures that are one and the same time the most remote and the nearest to us. Our departments in these subjects are growing rapidly and are attracting more students, certainly here and at my own university, but in national terms, they are only a major contribution to what is a minor program. The university then has thus become engaged on a variety of fronts in which previously it took little interest. The old concept of the academic world, exclusive, secretive, and self-adulatory, dies hard. But there are abundant indications of a profound change in the popular attitude towards the academic and the intellectual. Indeed, in some quarters, the attitude has changed from one of polite respect to one of wide-eyed deference. The change has taken place, first of all, and most markedly, in the sciences. It is beginning to appear in the social sciences. It is at least apparent in the humanities, although even there faint gleams of a new day are visible. The reason for the change is that the intellectual, to an extent and in a manner not known before, has suddenly begun to deliver the goods. Einstein, once the symbol of the benevolent but somewhat zany mathematician, is now recognized as one of the major creators of the world in which we live. It is, you will notice, the pure scientists and the mathematicians, the physicists particularly, who have suddenly become the doers and the creators. It is this, I think, that accounts for the amazing growth and popularity of the pure sciences and the relative decline, at least for the time being, in engineering. For in this new world, the engineer has lost caste. Today, the status of the university is determined by the number of Nobel Prize winners in science that it can display on its academic roster. Witness, for instance, the recent profile of the University of California in Time magazine. The social scientists can show no triumph comparable to that of the scientist. He has certainly done little to remake a world that in the area of human relations and human organization is as chaotic and as threatening as it ever was. But if he is not yet a scientist in his own area, he is clearly an engineer. He is increasingly the expert summoned to patch up legislation or to nail together a party platform. Moreover, he is not now the expert hired only by the party to the left, as was once the case. No political party on this continent is respectable without its constellation of academic experts. This new status has brought power, both within and without the university, and one might add, parenthetically, a greatly enlarged income. The sun of social approval and usefulness that has long shone upon the members of the professional faculty, and more recently on the pure scientist, has now reached the social scientist, and he rejoices in this heavenly alchemy. In this transformation of the intellectual into a man of affluence and power, the humanist has, as usual, not participated in a major fashion. But even on this rarefied soil, a few delicate green shoots are beginning to thrust their way up. The business world, with its passion for stimulating consumer demand and with its growing concern for the art of communication, now occasionally turns to the humanist for advice and inspiration. We have moved from an era, writes my colleague Marshall McLuhan, when business was our culture, to one in which culture is our business. What has been until recently the business of the university is now becoming the business of the business world itself. Most of the examples I have given emphasize the market value of the intellectual, which has risen greatly in response to the increasingly sophisticated demands of society. This has had a number of pleasant effects within the university. Academic salaries have risen. The sources of supplementary earning have multiplied and deepened, although only rarely to the blissful extent where one professor could boast that he used his university salary to pay his income tax on his consulting fees. And presidents, pathologically in search of funds, could point out that the ivory tower, if one looked at it closely, was really an atomic power plant. Scholars have thus become, in Roy Daniels' phrase, the paladins of a new era, who, and I here quote from his very witty speech which he gave at this university, who descend by jet planes upon remote and ill-governed communities. At once, guns cease to fire, crops and herds multiply, insects and virus diseases diminish, rulers reduce the number of their wives to four, sewage goes underground, dissident political elements do likewise. The academic has thus become a doer, And to that extent, his status has never been higher. But if he simply changes his old subsidiary preparatory role for a new bondage, then he becomes a means of accelerating a process that he plays no part in initiating. And this, it seems to me, and I come to the second part of my remarks this evening, this is the supreme challenge confronting the modern university. And upon its response to this will depend its emergence as a really creative force. There are a number of hopeful signs here. I might mention briefly one or two. First, there is the tendency for the creative writer to gravitate to the university campus. The typical young writer of the 1960s, it has been observed, is a serious young man lecturing to a room full of English literature students and wondering absently whether his application for a Guggenheim Award or a Canada Council Fellowship will be accepted. It is often suggested that this is a sign of literary decadence, that there is something inherently contradictory in the creative writer living and working in a university atmosphere. A more hopeful interpretation is that the writer recognizes that the university is a creator as well as a custodian of culture, and that in this atmosphere he can live and flourish. A rather plaintively despairing article on British universities in a recent issue of the Times Literary Supplement concludes on this positive note, at least positive as far as implications for the future of higher education are concerned. Since 1900, the university is called upon to perform many of the other functions that used to be catered for in other ways. The challenge of British universities to the British imagination is perhaps the most urgent of all. Another hopeful sign is the occasional tendency of the scientist to break through the old common sense, hard-boiled attitude of complete removal from social issues. C.P. Snow in The New Men tells us that the physicists, and I quote, whose whole intellectual life is spent in seeking new truths, found it uncongenial to stop seeking when they had a look at society. They were rebellious, questioning, protestant, curious of the future, and unable to resist shaping it. The engineers buckled to their jobs and gave no trouble. It was not from them, but from the scientists that came heretics, forerunners, martyrs, traitors. Well, so far, I hope I have been reasonably accurate and descriptive, although from time to time I have suggested an area which is in process of development and which might be looked upon as part of the new horizons. But now I propose to move on to a more speculative level and to make a few comments about the future of higher education in Canada, given this kind of background, this kind of explosive background, this vertical expansion combined with this horizontal expansion, this emergence of the academic as a doer and creator. We are faced then with a multiplicity of demands, with a variety of interests, and with a whole new series of obligations and responsibilities. The obvious reaction is to try to make the university a complete mirror of this complex world, and to make it serve as faithfully as it can the multiple needs of society. I would argue that the very opposite is required, and that when the field is so rich, we need to divide it up carefully. What we need most to do is to recognize the necessity for a variety of institutions devoted to higher learning, each of which moves in its individual way toward an assigned goal, not independent of the other or subservient to it. I may say that most of these remarks, I have my own province in mind, but perhaps some of my remarks may be more generally applicable. Among these institutions, the university should be the first and the most important. But it should not be the ultimate goal toward which all aspire. There could be nothing more salutary for our society today than the refurbishing of the concept of the university so that it becomes the true custodian of the intellectual life. I'm not trying to establish an antithesis between elite and popular cultures, which I think is false and unfortunate. Provided we establish other institutions that are concerned with general education and with the practical application of knowledge, whether it be in the fields of engineering or music or the arts, there need be no bad conscience about exclusiveness. It is just as important to discourage some people from going to university as to encourage others to go. And in certain areas, it is just as important to maintain flexible academic standards as it is in others to insist upon the most rigid ones. Only by a system such as this will it be possible to contain and develop the vast fluctuating world of higher education with the warring elements that I have tried to describe. Even with this decentralization of higher education that I am suggesting, we shall not escape from the problem of bigness and its corollary, which is even more dangerous, the problem of inhumanity. We are witnessing today in the large university, and I see signs of it at my own, a progressive retreat from the student. It has become fashionable to write off the undergraduate as an ineffective person who is just amiably about the place. The master's degree is the most recent academic coinage to be debased. And now the same disintegrating process is at work with the doctor's degree. I am told that there are universities in the United States where the more distinguished members of the staff will deal only with postdoctorate students, the only genuinely mature student, on the grounds that all others are incapable of pursuing research. We have thus, within the large university, an increasing separation between the various academic elements, a sort of progressive alienation of one group from the other. Research has become an obsessive end in itself, and before it, everything else disappears or fades into insignificance. To counteract this, I think that we need to think in terms of the reconstitution of the academic society, so as to make it possible for all parts of it to live and work together, not only within the classroom and the laboratory, but outside in the more informal context that a university community makes possible. The classical solution of this problem has been the Oxford and Cambridge college system, which is usually bound up with the idea of a highly selective, aristocratic intellectual society, and of course, a very high degree of endowment. There is no question, of course, of transposing this system to the new world. But I still think that this general idea can be adapted to new conditions, provided we are ready to admit that the ideals of intimacy and close community obtainable in the Oxbridge system can no longer be secured here. And perhaps, Mr. President, you will permit me to illustrate what I have in mind by describing the kind of problem at my own university and giving you a rough outline of the solution that we have in mind for it. As you may know, the University of Toronto, within its Faculty of Arts and Science, is a federated system in which instruction in the basic humanities is carried on by four distinct and autonomous colleges. Each college has its own residential system, and the college and residence are inseparable. In our new expansion plans, we gave heavy consideration to the problem of residences, and in the early stages had decided to erect two or three huge residential buildings to accommodate approximately 1,500 students. The effect of this proposal on the structure of the university would have been disastrous. The university would have been split into two different universities, one of which was based upon the federated system and linked to residences and colleges, the other of which was really just the big American Unitary University with a number of instructional buildings surrounded by an academic suburbia of big apartment houses. At the same time, we were faced with the problem of how to provide residential accommodation for such a large group of students without committing ourselves in hopeless expenditures. Well, the solution was to think of the residences as residential colleges and to provide in our plans for two areas in these residences that had not been originally scheduled. The first was a number of offices for administrative and academic officials and for tutors in the college. The second was space where non-residential members could meet for lunch or for social occasions. The idea then is to attach to the residence a group of non-residential members and a core of faculty members who will be associated with the college and who will engage in a certain amount of informal instruction. Moreover, these new colleges will be multi-faculty in composition, and in this respect will differ from the original colleges, which are confined to subjects in the Faculty of Arts. In this way, we hope to provide social and intellectual centers that will cut across professional boundaries. We are hoping that we will be able to do this without the expenditure of a great deal more money than we had originally planned. Certainly without any thought of following the kind of expensive traditional architecture that is usually associated with the college system. This is an attempt to put some old ideas into some new bottles. And one can only hope that the spirits will not entirely lose their tang. Well, I have suggested then, Mr. President, in a very general way, two ways in which the University of the Future can equip itself to deal with the new problems. If I may just recapitulate, the first problem is the threatening dissipation of energies that so many new and exciting responsibilities bring. And the suggested solution is a clarification of aims and obligations and their expression in a variety of institutions of higher education. The second problem is what we might describe as the inhuman academicism involved in the constant pursuit of new knowledge. And the solution is the recreation of the old concept of the academic human community. I have in these remarks, sir, carefully avoided any specific reference to money. I am not, I assure you, unaware of this problem, but I will content myself now with quoting a scriptural text which I think gives a flourishing summary of all fundraising orations. The text is Ecclesiastes 10 and 19. A feast is made for laughter, and wine maketh merry, but money answereth all things. To this scriptural exhortation, I would add simply that we should become accustomed to placing before the public the real dimensions of our financial needs. There is now a ready acceptance of the expenditure of huge sums of money on primary and secondary school education. But there is a formidable reluctance about spending large sums of money on higher education. University administrators, I assure you, and I have the effrontery to say this even in front of Larry McKenzie, university administrators are reticent salesmen, content to seek money only to maintain a holding operation when they should be asking for supplies for a major attack. Well, my title, you will have noticed, has a nationalistic flick at the end of it, and I would like to conclude with an appropriate contribution to the great current question to which Dr. McKenzie has just made such a distinguished contribution. I'm convinced that in this country, universities are the key institutions in national development and in the elaboration of our world role. Today, the old economic forces upon which this nation was tenuously founded are subjected to greater and greater strain. And if we are to survive as a nation, we must substitute a flow of ideas and information. This can be done only through books, newspapers, through radio, television, through the creation of cultural centers such as the festivals at Stratford, at Montreal, and here at Vancouver. And all of these are fed by the universities. They are streams that would shrink into dry runnels if the universities did not exist. On the international plane, I have already made some suggestions about the place of the universities. Because of them, we can play a positive role in deepening the bases of our understanding of other cultures, in contributing to the training of experts for the new countries, and in helping to establish that international community of the mind, which we hope is the harbinger of a wider community. We can do little in Canada about the great deterrent. We can do much about a great propellant. Canadian universities are ready to shoulder heavy responsibilities. They rank high in public esteem, and in all fundamental matters, they speak with one voice. There are many things for them to do in the future, and I believe that they will be given the means to do them.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great privilege this evening to have with us the honorary president of the Institute and our distinguished and respected president of our university. I now ask him to give his the thanks of our audience and to the speaker this evening. Dr. McKenzie. I'm going to make an announcement. I wonder if you would care to sit down and wait till after.
To Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, the first thing I would like to do is to express to Mr. Nemetz and to the officers and members of the Vancouver Institute the thanks of those of us at the university, and the thanks, I'm sure, of many others throughout our community for their success in bringing to this campus and to this community our guest tonight and other distinguished and interesting speakers. I make mention of this particularly because I think this is the first occasion on which Dr. Bissell has had the opportunity of a formal appearance before an audience in the university building here. Soon after he was appointed to the University of Toronto, we did invite him to come out to one of our congregations to give the congregation address and to receive an honorary degree. Unfortunately for us, it was not possible for him because of the other demands upon his time to be with us. I would like to tell him that I'm sure that the Senate of our university considers the proposal that he should accept an honorary degree from us at an appropriate and convenient time as being understood. And in a sense, His degree is in cold storage, if you like, or on order. Now, my path has crossed that of Dr. Bissell so many times and in so many fields of common interest that it's difficult for me to express my thanks and your thanks without another speech. He was at Toronto when I was a member of the staff of that university. He had the good sense to join a regiment of Canadian Highlanders wearing the same kilt that I wore in World War I. He followed in World War II. He's even had the questionable sense to become the president of two Canadian universities. And that's a formidable proposition, I assure you, for any Canadian. I meet him, understandably, in most of our university organizations, and more recently, as the chairman of the Canada Council. He and I were in Ottawa for the first 3 days of this week at the most recent meetings of that organization, and I was very happy to be a party to persuading my colleagues that the university should receive something over $550,000 toward the first unit of our fine arts center, which will be just on the parking lot here, to make it more difficult for all of you to park, but it will still be a very lovely and interesting building when complete. Now, Dr. Bissell has done for us tonight a very necessary and important task. He has reviewed for us the functions and the changes in of universities and in universities. He has told us something of their problems. He has told us something of their importance. And he has illustrated for us, out of his own experience, particularly with that great university, the University of Toronto, some of the solutions of the problems which face all of us in this field of higher education today. I wish there were time to pursue with him many of these suggestions that he has made. I hope that on other occasions, here and in other places, we will have the opportunity of hearing him expand upon these suggestions he has made tonight. But tonight, I would like, on your behalf, and on behalf of the university, in person, to tell him how much we appreciate his taking time out of an extremely busy life to come out here to Vancouver and to speak to us this evening as he has done. We're very grateful for that. We're happy that whoever arranged the visit should have had the foresight to have it coincide with the Grey Cup game, because I had the pleasure, together with Mrs. McKenzie, of having Dr. Bissell with us at the game this afternoon, and he was rooting ardently for the Ottawa Rough Riders. May even have made a little money out of them, I don't know. But He tells me that he did have a bet, a winning bet of $3 with somebody whose name he's forgotten. If that person is in the hall, you better let him know before you leave. But in any event, Dr. Bissell, whether it be a Grey Cup game or a convocation or a personal and private visit, we give you a very warm welcome here at the university and in Vancouver, and we thank you for coming.
Ladies and gentlemen, I should like to make a few remarks before we adjourn this evening. One is in regard to the problem of questions. I think it's quite apparent to you that with our distinguished roster of speakers, it is not always possible to provide a period for questions after the speech. On some occasions, the speech itself does not lend itself easily to questions. On other occasions, the speaker himself is en route to another visit, as in the case of Dr. Bissell, who is en route to California. And we must, therefore, the executive of your institute, decide on those evenings on your behalf what evenings these questions will be forthcoming. We are delighted to have questions at all times, but they cannot, unfortunately, this year be at every meeting. There are some other talks that are coming up, I'm sure, which we will have the opportunity for further another time. The second thing is regard to the space arrangements. We have a problem at the university here wherein we only have the largest room, or practically the largest room, is the Buchanan Building, 106. This is a room which takes only some 300, and 300 is crowding. And on some occasions, we've had some of our members have to sit behind those dividers at the back of the hall and not hear the address very well. We've tried to get this auditorium, but naturally, this is the only auditorium at the university, and it is in great demand by the student body. We hope that you'll take note of the fact that with Dr. McKenzie and Dr. Bissell are on the one the chairman, another a director of the Canada Council, and I think I should give them notice that we need a theater here of about 450 seats, and we hope they'll vote right. In the meanwhile, ladies and gentlemen, one of the other more sinister influences at work is to have you join this organization in order to form some sort of a nucleus to support such a theater if and when we get it. We have some 400 members in the institute, and we are trying very hard this year to make it 500. We therefore invite you, those of you who are not yet members, to join the institute. There's a young lady usually at the back of the hall, and you can pay her your $2 to join, and we'd be very grateful to see if we can't make this objective this year that the board and executive have set of 500 members. Now, Dr. Bissell's address was the first, the opening address, of a series of three within the larger series. He gave the sort of keynote address on this question, much vexed question of higher education. The next speaker is the second speaker in this special series, intro the program, and that is Dr. Davidson Dunton, the president of Carleton University and the former head of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. He will be our guest either here or at 106 Buchanan Building, and we will have a commissioner there if we change over to this auditorium. We hope to have this auditorium next Saturday night. And his speech will be on the subject, Who Should Go to College?, which will follow Dr. Bissell's address. The third speech in this category in the series will take place on January the 14th, when Dr. Murray Ross, the president of York University, the new university in the Toronto area, and the former vice president of the University of Toronto, will speak on the question, Are universities getting too big? So you will, by the end of January the 14th, all be experts in the field of higher education, we hope. Another note I should make to you is that the last lecture before Christmas, the December the 10th lecture, will not be as stated. Unfortunately, Dr. Cowan will be in Washington, D.C. on that day, and he will exchange his lecture with Dr. Gibson. And Dr. Gibson will take the lecture on December the 10th and speak on the genesis of new ideas in science. He is, as you know, our new professor of the history of medicine and science at our university here. And has just recently returned from Yale University. He will take the lecture on December the 10th. And Dr. Cowan will therefore take the lecture on March the 18th. I give you notice of that so that you may change that on your program. Thank you very much for coming this evening. Good night.